right, welcome everyone. We're here for oral arguments on our CV 240478 Asbury versus Summit et al. As you may know, we record and live stream these proceedings, so when you stand up to the podium, if you'd please give us your name and your client's name before you begin. You each have a maximum of 20 minutes. You keep track of your own time if you'd like to reserve some for rebuttal. And keep in mind that we have read all of your briefing, we've studied the record, and we conferenced this case this morning. And so when you're ready, you may proceed.
I rise for a procedural point.
Yes.
Okay. I'm in an unusual position of being a cross appellant. So I was wondering, do I get a couple minutes at the very end for my rebuttal on my cross appeal?
Well, normally we would require you to absorb your time with each other on one side, but I have no, does anyone have any? Go ahead.
One way we've seen it done is that your cross appeal reply would go forth, but you have to exercise care when arguing the reply in support of your cross appeal not to touch anything that came in the earlier argument. You know, you only get to talk about cross appeal stuff.
For the rebuttal time at the very end, I would say nothing except something related to the cross appeal.
Yeah, so you could never go back and last word what he had just said before
I'm
just saying that okay. That's when it's done that way, at least that's a strict prohibition.
I tell you what, when it's, we can add 3 minutes to the clock, and then do you mind? Or do you want him to absorb it in
his time? I defer to you as our presiding as to how many
I'm
minutes.
I'm fine with a couple of extra minutes, but you sides. Also, neither side is required to use all of their 20 minutes, so we reserve the right to meld you into that if there's time left. How's that?
So do I get 23 minutes or just 20 minutes?
I was saying a few minutes. I thought you were saying you wanted to have just a couple of minutes, Abney.
Yeah, I just want to carve out some of my 20 minutes.
Okay.
All I'm proposing, so maybe use 18 and then say 2 to 3.
Well,
now I'm getting confused.
If you watch the clock, if you're responsible for your time, so
yes.
If you want to carve out time, you can. I think we would allow that.
Yeah.
But
okay.
That's on you, though.
Yeah,
right.
No,
for to decide how much of the time, but you'll get a chance to speak, and you need to confer about that. So we won't add any time for now, but I'll reserve the right to change that if something happens. But you guys need to work out how you're splitting that time. But we will definitely give you time when it's appropriate.
Okay, I appreciate
and if
your
I time. Miss it, you can kind of start to stand up and alert me that it's your time to talk.
All right.
All right.
So just make sure I understand. So they're going second and fourth.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And you mind your own time and you're second and fourth. That's what we said, right?
Okay.
Thank you.
Ron.
Okay.
Got it. Thank you. Sorry that
Thank
took a
much.
Minute to get there, but I appreciate
I mean,
you raising it.
I mean to confuse things, but it just occurred to me.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Let's start.
Thank you, Your Honor. Fred Yarger, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the defendants, Dr. Jared Hall and Summit Healthcare. And on that procedural point, I would like to try to reserve some time today, both for my rebuttal and to respond to the cross-appellate arguments during my colleague's time. A new trial is required in this case due to the repeated misconduct of plaintiff's counsel in front of the jury. This misconduct was not an isolated incident, and it was not an honest mistake. It occurred throughout the entire closing argument, and it was done in specific violation of multiple court orders that were entered before trial and reaffirmed during trial, specifically to ensure a fair and level playing field. The misconduct fell into three categories. First, plaintiff's counsel showed the jury 21 different slides that showed misleading excerpts of deposition testimony of my client, Dr. Hall, that had never been offered, that the court had no opportunity to review, that there were no opportunities for objections to, and that was never actually admitted into the trial record.
Well, when you say opportunity for objection, I'm not sure that a court provides you with an opportunity other than being a willing source to hear any objection that you raise. But can we stop in the deposition thing for just a minute and just
yes.
kind of swim in that pond while we, I understand what, in reading the closing argument and how that played out, that it's a fluid event and, you know, objection was made that just the blanket deposition transcript quote should not be in because it wasn't admitted. That was clear. What I'm struggling with is that in the Rule 59 motion, that after time for reflection and a trial transcript and a deposition transcript, that I just don't see what is different. Because to me, there is a difference between putting up quoted deposition testimony that is the same in substance as the testimony at trial, but that contains something substantive which the jury heard, but that had not been part of the evidence. And when I thought I would see a lot in the Rule 59 motion, like, here it all is, and here's how we were prejudiced by. And of course, we didn't have time to stand up and know exactly what the differences were. That was hard, sure, in the closing. But now that we have, we're here, and I'm on page 7 or 8, 14 of your Rule 59 motion, and I see the graphic, but I don't see that played out. And so when I'm thinking about prejudice, I have, sure, a hard time understanding, just in the deposition statements, where your client was prejudiced.
Understood, Your Honor. Let me try to address all of those points through a couple of clarifications. First, and this is the key legal error that the trial court engaged in, we are not under the burden, given the particular issues that we are raising on appeal, to demonstrate prejudice. That is the central error that we are contending the trial court made here. Levy is quite clear. Varco is quite clear. Prejudice is not the inquiry. We do not have to show prejudice. What we have to show is a deliberate violation of court orders.
Well, you have to show all three parts of Levy, and then,
yes,
prejudice is inferred, but you have to show all three.
That's true, Your Honor. Yes, and that's perfectly correct. There are three elements. But what we don't have to do is make the, quote, showing of actual prejudice that Levy said you do not have to show. In terms of your answers to your questions, what we tried to do before Judge Ruckel, and we attached it to our brief here, was we created a table demonstrating how the deposition excerpts really took pages and pages of trial testimony on the same subject and distilled them into misleading sound bites, which is not what the jury heard. The jury is required to decide a case based on the evidence it actually
but
hears
wasn't
in the
courtroom. Wasn't the lawyer allowed to characterize the evidence, to summarize it, characterize it in argument? I mean, it's different than saying what he said in opening. He's making a closing argument. He is taking things and putting the best spin on them, summarizing them in a way that he can illustrate to the jury, proves his point. And if it's not inaccurate, he's allowed to do that. So I'm struggling,
right,
with, like, what that line is, too, if that's the objection.
Sure. And with respect, it wasn't accurate. Probably the best example of it is page 32 of our opening brief, where we provide testimony that was in the deposition that was never given at trial. It was a question about whether my client, Dr. Hall, agreed that it was careless for him not to inquire about the prior MRSA infection. Carelessness is not the standard. He never testified to that in trial. It wasn't in evidence.
Couldn't you have said to the jury, he could admit he was careless every day and twice on Sunday, that's not the standard that you have? I mean, is that a response in argument?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, because that simply highlights unadmitted testimony that should never have been before the jury. And to put a finer point on this, Your Honor, Judge Ruckel held very, very specifically, yes, you can, during opening in particular, you can mention statements made in deposition. That's a fair game because that should be a fair preview of trial testimony. Do not put it up on the boards, because there's a danger that you're going to be showing the jury in an authoritative format, verbatim with citations to the deposition, this is what you heard and this is what you're going to hear. That's not true. What they're required to do is decide a case based on the evidence that actually came in at trial, not based on depositions that were taken many, many months before that were never tested, never disclosed, and never admitted into evidence. And I don't want to dally here too long. I'm already into argument a fair amount. And I take your point, Your Honor. But there was other misconduct that Judge Ruckel was very, very concerned about. Said it was a close case. On reflection, regretted the weaker curative instruction that she gave. And that misconduct, again, deliberately violated pretrial orders affirmed during trial about permissible lines of argument and analogy. at the most critical point in closing argument, right when plaintiff's counsel was asking the jury, making the ask of the jury, the amount of money and the liability and comparative fault findings, plaintiff's counsel told the jury, if he's not listening now, it's going to happen again. Put up in front of the jury another slide with a smiling picture of my client with the caption, will it happen again? As Judge Ruckel found, this was a thinly veiled attempt to ask the jury to send a message through its verdict. This is a compensatory case. This is not a punitive case. That's improper. It was also a violation of the ruling on the motion in limine trying to prevent and prohibit golden rule and reptile arguments, which encouraged this jury in this small community to consider harm to themselves and possibly their loved ones and third parties. That is impermissible. That's not the basis that a jury is allowed to use to come to a verdict. And then finally, counsel used this improper analogy to the Titanic, and it went beyond a simple analogy, as Judge Ruckel found. It was specifically designed to bring up this conception in the eyes of the jury, the 1,500 deaths in a case of recklessness. This was a single case of alleged medical negligence. The Titanic analogy had absolutely no relevance. So, and the most concerning thing is that plaintiff's counsel admitted that he knew about the Standard Chartered ruling, knew about this court's concern about that very analogy, and used it anyway. I'm sorry,
Your Honor. Is a Titanic analogy always off limits because of the dire catastrophe of it? Is that what you're arguing?
I can't think of a case in which simple negligence is alleged and making this kind of direct plea to emotion and about the, quote, cold dark night in 1912, those are words directly from the closing argument, where that is a possibly permissible metaphor that can be used to elucidate the evidence in the law. That's the test. Is the analogy being used to elucidate the evidence in the law, or is it being used to distract from the evidence and to try to inflame the passions of the jury? This court in Standard Chartered held that's what the analogy did there. That's exactly why it was being raised here. It wasn't to highlight or explain, it was to inflame.
It seems like one point of the Titanic analogy is to say warnings were made and ignored.
And
I'm not sure why. I do take your point about the extreme loss of life, but the point is valid, I suppose.
I don't disagree with you that this theme of ignored warnings was permissible. There are many ways you can highlight that theme. Red flag itself is a metaphor. There wouldn't be a problem with saying that this was a red flag and that red flags weren't heeded or followed or paid attention to. The problem with this argument was it was a deliberate attempt to try to get the jury to think about inaccurate, misleading notions that there was catastrophic loss of life waiting in the wings if the jury didn't do something about it in this courtroom and send a message. That's exactly what should not be going on in a courtroom in a case of negligence.
Well, counsel, you're not really saying that if you take away the morphing of your client into Captain Smith, that makes it like personal, that they're killing a lot of people, and you take away the ask for an essentially punitive outcome, you're not saying that mere reference to the Titanic is impermissible to the point of Judge Howe's prior question, are you?
I'm not going that far. I don't think Judge Ruckel...
I don't think Standard Chartered says that.
Sure, absolutely. And Judge Ruckel acknowledged during opening, she said, mm-hmm. fine, an innocuous metaphor talking about the Titanic, fine. Mm-hmm. But she sat through closing, she watched it, and on reflection in her post-trial order said this went way beyond a simple analogy. This was a call for the jury to send a message with its verdict. That's not permissible. So I do want to touch on the three elements of Levy, because that is the controlling test. And as Your Honor pointed out, there are three elements, and if those elements are satisfied, what the Arizona Supreme Court held in Levy and this court reaffirmed in Varco, and what occurred in Levy, was that the trial court itself is empowered to order a new trial, and that's what we're requesting. And respectfully, we think that Levy compels that result.
Maybe you could talk about the third Levy element in particular?
Of course. That element is was the misconduct, quote, apparently successful? The key to that element, I think, is Varco's clarification that we are not put to the burden of showing that the jury got it wrong. An erroneous result is not a prerequisite to finding that the Levy test has been satisfied. I think the best example I can give you of a case in which this kind of misconduct was not apparently successful is perhaps the Grant case, the 1982 case from the Arizona Supreme Court. There, the misconduct was very directly tied to a claim for punitive damages, but the jury didn't award punitive damages. So when the misconduct goes to an issue or a claim or a defense that the jury just doesn't reach, or which is decided in a way that's favorable to the moving party, I think that's a case in which the misconduct was not apparently successful. Here it was. The jury found liability, and it awarded multi-million dollars in damages in direct response to exactly what plaintiff's counsel requested and asked them to do. So under the test in Levy, I think that that element is clearly satisfied by this verdict because the misconduct was directly tied to issues of damages and issues of liability.
Should we be considering the curative instructions in the third prong of Levy?
I don't think you should hear one under Levy at all because that's not part of the prongs, it's not part of the analysis. Even if you were to look at those curatives, I don't think they were sufficient here. And,
Are you saying that we shouldn't consider them in the third prong because they'd never be relevant, that a court, once this happens, can never do anything mid-trial to correct course?
Let me read you what Levy says, and this is my interpretation of it. There's a three-part test
right. That
really is geared toward, we need to make sure that this was a fair playing field.
Well, I've read Levy, and I don't want you to waste your time.
Sure. Just
want to know whether your answer to whether you think that the curative instructions are part of the analysis in the third prong.
I don't think they are, but here's what Levy said. We cannot adopt a rule that allows lawyers to knowingly and deliberately raise inadmissible and inflammatory matters, exactly what happened here, on the bare assumption that any harm will be cured by a stock instruction. The judge's instruction here was very much a stock instruction. It was given... I can read it to you. The counsel may have shown deposition statements. If they were shown, you cannot consider them. They were shown. There were 21 different slides. You saw a slide. Will it happen again? Please disregard. It's an improper argument. Those weren't sufficient to cure the prejudice. They weren't even given in writing to the jury. So I think under Levy...
Did you request they be given in writing to the jury? Because you were the one who helped craft them and asked that they be... not told to the jury until all of the instructions. Did you request them to be in writing? Did you submit a
written
instruction?
We requested a very
could have included in the packet.
Yes, we requested a very specific, different worded instruction.
But once you guys landed on yes, Your Honor, I think if you include it's improper, that's what we're kind of landing on. Did you request that somebody put it in writing?
I don't believe that request was made, but it was because...
I don't believe it was either.
I'm wondering why
you're putting such an emphasis on it when no one asked her to put it in writing and put it in the packet. That's
sure.
All.
And Judge Ruckel kind of made that decision on her own. She said specifically, I'm not going to put in this in writing because I don't want to draw attention to it. And I think that's precisely the problem. We are drawing attention to it, and it's something that should never have been before the jury in the first place.
So do you concede? If you're not, that's fine. The case talks about a stock instruction. If the court had given the instruction that you requested, could they have cured the problem?
I don't think it would have, Your Honor. The primary request made just after the argument was for a mistrial. We believe that's the only way to cure this kind of misconduct.
So you were asking the court to do something that you believe was ineffective?
No. What we did was we said, we need a mistrial here, Your Honor. She said, I think a curative is sufficient. And then we simply provided the court alternative language on a curative on the assumption that she had already made that ruling.
And you made... clear that you didn't think this would help?
I'm sorry, what was that?
You made clear you didn't think your instruction would help?
Yeah, I think the main point here is I don't think we ever abandoned our position that a mistrial was the cure for this particular issue.
Okay.
It seemed down to 3 minutes and 20, and I'd like to reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is David Abney. I'm here representing the plaintiff, appellee, cross appellant. They get to the last day of a 9-day trial, and at closing argument, the very last, well, next to last sentence, if you take thank you as a last sentence, but the next to last sentence, and discussing Captain Smith, I'll tell you now, this is a case about a man who ignored all the warnings. That's accurate enough. We're talking about the Dr. Hall. Who ignored all the signs, talking about Dr. Hall. And if he is not listening now, then it could happen again. It's not an appeal to passion. It's not inflammatory, but it's not the right thing to say at that point.
But isn't it a pretty pejorative example?
One more time, Your Honor?
Isn't it a pretty pejorative example to use the term? In another context, if you liken someone to Hitler, you're mm-hmm. really going over the, you're way over the line.
No, I don't think it's a pejorative. It's a good metaphor because there's a general common understanding that Captain Smith made some very bad errors and that resulted in a catastrophe.
In a huge disaster.
Right, a huge disaster, but still, for Tracy, this was a huge disaster for her on a personal level. But yeah, it's good because it takes you to the point that there is a point in time where you can hear the warnings, you can see the signs, and you can take effective action. And Captain Smith is a prime example of somebody who did not read the signs, did not see, did not heed the warnings, and warnings came in to the captain. And I know he was exonerated by the official board of inquiry, but I think that was more to keep transatlantic travel going strong, which is, of course, incredibly ironic because in 2 years, in 1914, the Germans would start sinking ships. And it would be totally unsafe to travel from 1914 to 1918.
Well, why don't we, instead of talking about transoceanic travel, why don't we talk a little bit about slide 17, which I think is more to the center of opposing counsel's argument. How can one justify slide 17? I'll just start you with that. I have a few more questions about it.
I think there's somewhere in my ears today. Could you repeat that?
Sure. Slide 17 is the big slide that was in their motion for a new trial. It's in their appellate brief, and it says, question. So would your answer to my question then be, quote, yes, unquote, question mark? It would be careless to take a patient and not make any effort to inquire about infection, question mark. There's a picture of the defendant, and it says yes, and in teeny, teeny print, it's cited three pages of text, which is interesting. It's just one word, yes. How does one justify airing a summary that isn't even a literal transliteration of deposition testimony when that deposition testimony was never admitted in the trial given the judge's pretrial instructions? How does one justify doing this in a closing argument, counsel?
One would say that it's trying to summarize the evidence that was presented by that particular witness.
But then why is it cited to deposition testimony they never see if it's meant to summarize the trial testimony?
Well, when there is a designation like that, when there is a problem like that, you go to the trial judge and say, we've got a problem here, and we need to fix it. And here the trial judge looked at everything, considered all these arguments, and said, I think it's close enough.
Close enough to what?
Close enough that it's not going to distract the jury or lead the jury astray. Well, but this is reasonable argument to make.
Okay, but close enough to what? What is the object to which this is close? What is the object of your comparison close enough that you're imputing to the judge? Like slide 17 is close to what?
We're talking about specific things that are quoted in slide 17?
I mean, I just read, you know, for you, but what is slide 17 close to that justifies presenting it as putting a spin on the trial testimony? What would justify that? I mean, is there a specific page of trial testimony you can point me to where he called himself careless, or is it just kind of close enough to what he said in the trial? And if so, where did he say what was, quote, close enough to that?
Offhand, I cannot think of a point like that, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough.
But all of this was brought up to the trial court, the trial judge, who saw all the evidence in the case, considered all the slides, and the Rule 59 motion after that, and said, this is not so bad that it's prejudiced you and you have an unfair trial.
Well, but, I mean, again, getting away from the conclusion that it's not so bad, I think we have to decide as a court of appeals whether it is so bad, and the way we do that is by deciding whether it's closely analogous to or duplicates trial testimony, and you've said you cannot point me to trial testimony that this summarizes. So why would you need three pages? How could you summarize three pages of trial testimony in the one word yes? I mean, doesn't that sort of imply very strongly to the reader, if you get down to the fine point, that it's not a fulsome summary?
It could have been more accurate, is all I can say, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough. Sorry.
But it was in the ballpark. I mean, everything that was presented was in the ballpark.
But that's my point. You're using this general comparison. It's close enough. It's in the ballpark. Close enough to what? You need not to supply an object of comparison, or we must assume that this is inaccurate. You need to tell me what it is so close to that renders it as such a fair summary of testimony that, though never admitted before the jury, it's okay to throw it up in a closing. That's, I think, your task in the argument.
It's a summary of the evidence in the case that Dr. Hall was negligent. Negligence is carelessness, isn't it?
But the point is that he said he was careless. It isn't like your contention that he's careless or your excellent trial lawyer's contention that he's careless. The point is, does it fairly summarize to the jury what he said about himself, right? Or otherwise, it's really not fair.
Then that is a point for the defense to object to strongly and specifically to the trial court and convince the trial court that some sort of corrective action is needed at that point. All the way to a mistrial is too far in a situation like this where the evidence is very strong about the malpractice.
So what's your more convincing piece of evidence that he was careless than his own admission that he apparently didn't make that he was careless? What's your best piece of evidence, if this isn't it, in the trial?
Best piece of evidence that he's careless?
Yeah. I mean, this is a great jury verdict. It's three times the amount requested, $1.7 million. It comes to 5.9, back to 4.6. It's a great jury verdict, well tried. If this isn't the best admission in the entire case plaintiff has, what is?
The best admission?
Sure. Sure. What's the most discrediting testimony?
This may sound stupid and a little bit foggy, but throughout, Dr. Hall made admission after admission that he was not following this patient closely, that he was not bringing her in for examinations, that he was not providing her with the advice, specific advice that she needed, and with the strong care that she needed to make sure that she didn't get MRSA in the first place, and that if she got MRSA, that it would be treated swiftly and efficiently. The constant course of testimony from him backs up the expert opinion that he violated the standard of care quite thoroughly.
Those are excellent admissions to bring forth to the jury, but it seems misleading to summarize all that into a yes, I was careless.
I see your point, Your Honor. And all I can do about that is to say that the evidence was awfully strong that he was indeed careless. And if the one slide is objectionable, then object to it.
It is incumbent on the attorney to represent his client and argue, all these admissions show that he was careless. That's proper argument. But to say, to quote a deposition, which isn't just a summary, an actual quote, that yes, I was careless, that seems out of the ballpark.
He didn't testify. That word.
The solution for something like that is to make an objection, a direct, immediate objection to the trial court, and get corrective action taken right there.
But I found there was an objection to the use of the
general objection to this, to the use of these slides, saying that they didn't accurately summarize this, that, and the other. But you need to be specific. And if you can't be specific in the heat of the moment, we've all been there, either. From your perspective, you've been there from the bench, and from the lawyers, as lawyers, your perspective looking up at the bench, sometimes you're in the heat of things and you just don't have the mental energy or the time.
Between the rock and the hard place, when there had been an admonition not to use deposition quotes in the opening. I mean, the idea of being prepared to be peppered with 21 slides of deposition quotes when you sat at your closing argument, being prepared to defend against the testimony that the jury actually heard, to say that they had to, I mean, and they had a second shot at the Rule 59 motion they made, but I find that a little disingenuous. Like, why didn't they react more quickly? Well, because there was something that they never thought should be a part of the closing argument that was speeding by on PowerPoint slides, having summaries from three deposition pages that they'd never thought to be prepared to defend against, flashing on the screen to the jury. That's a lot.
This is assuming that these lawyers didn't know the case inside and out. And by the time they get to closing argument, both sets of lawyers know the case inside and out. The defense lawyers can look at the slides in an instant and say, hold on, this is not right. Get up and object. And object again if you need to. And just keep objecting. That's your job as a lawyer when you're in a closing argument. The other side's making a closing argument. You're not happy with it. You pay close attention and you get up and you make your objection. I mean, lawyers do this all the time during cross-examination, direct examination, arguments, opening statements. They get up and they make the objection because they're alert and they're paying attention.
Do you dispute that in the new trial briefing in front of the trial court that they raised specifically that slide 17 reflected testimony that was wholly unsupported by trial testimony? Do you dispute that they said that before she denied the new trial?
Well, that happened, and then it's up to the trial judge to decide what to do about it.
Right. Now, in fairness to you, I was reading out of page 9 of their reply brief, but you agree that that happened. You agree that they made the very argument we're discussing in the new trial practice.
That was one of the arguments they made, Your Honor.
Yes, yes.
But then again, you go, well, who gets the first crack at deciding this, and who has the discretion to decide what to do about it? Is it bad enough to throw out an entire 9-day trial?
Well, it's unusual for, and admittedly, that weighs into the calculus when you're a trial judge and you've done this hard work and you're in this smaller community and people come together for this trial. It's an important event. Everybody cares deeply
right.
about it. But it's unusual also for a trial judge to admit that their curative instruction probably should have been stronger. Not could have been, but should have been. That's unusual in your experience, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so, Your Honor.
Okay.
But speaking of curative instructions, to veer back to the mm-hmm. Titanic, there was a curative instruction about that. Mm-hmm. And even if it were to cite something like send a message, I'm not quite sure who the message is going to. Dr. Hall? Maybe? The podiatric community? I don't know who the message is going to.
Well, he has to listen or he's going to do it again. I mean, that's a pretty clear imputation of the closing, right?
It would be, I guess it's directed at him then.
Yeah,
okay,
I guess so.
But then the judge did a curative instruction. And like I say, this is basically the last 12 words of the case, and you're done. That thing would make the whole case to be a mistrial, that one little phrase when there's a curative instruction? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think it's not just the one little phrase. I think it's also the manufactured testimony in slide 17 that the jury had never heard before. That was warranted as a conclusory admission that you would dream of eliciting in a deposition that, yeah, I was careless. It's those two things together, maybe.
It's in the first instance, it's up to the trial judge to say, well, what is the effect here? Is it sufficient that the whole case has to go away?
Okay. Can you please speak, before you lose time, to element 3 of Levy as we ask opposing counsel? That would be helpful because I think we're focused in on that a little bit.
Okay, one more time.
Can you please speak to element 3 of Levy, the three Levy factors?
And what is element 3?
Element 3 actually turns out to be whether or not it was likely that the misconduct succeeded. That's element 3 of the Levy test.
I don't know how you predict if it's likely that misconduct of this nature succeeded or did not succeed. The trial judge concluded that there was not so much of a problem that needed to grant a new trial.
But that's a different answer to the question. As Judge Jacobs says, the third element of Levy is, did it succeed? Did that help the client with the jury?
I don't know how you prove that. But you know, if you're a defense lawyer and you've seen these slides, what would you do logically? You'd say, put the slides back on the screen. Let's take a look at this. You see down here? That's not true. Why not do that? You could certainly do that as a defense lawyer. You could point out to the jury, well, this is not right.
But that's not, the question is whether what happened helped the client succeed with the jury.
But again, how can you know that? And the trial of this length with so much evidence of wrongdoing, you point one small thing right here and you say, this is, the whole case spins on that?
Well, the jury award was much more than was asked for, wasn't it?
I don't... No, I don't think so. And what was awarded was actually fairly... I think it's fairly modest considering the amount of harm that was caused. And then you get into the one point of the cross-appeal, if I may, that there was no evidence, disclosed evidence, that that Tracy did something wrong to cause her own injury. I mean, you get this very strange jury question toward the end of the testimony by the standard of care expert, Dr. Schubert. Out of the blue, the jury says, well, basically, you know, if she'd done the solutions differently, would that have an effect? And he, out of the blue, he says, well, sure. He's like, that was never disclosed. And it,
did you give the trial judge a chance to make an editor along the lines of your cross-appeal?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did you move the trial judge for the editor you request from us?
It's not an editor, I believe.
Whatever you want to call it, did you ask the trial judge to do it? Did you give her a chance on Rule 59 to do the thing you're asking us to fix?
They said, no, you can't do comparative fault. So there would have been no 22% allocation. So when you say to the trial judge, there cannot be comparative fault in this case, and a motion in limine, and again, in arguments throughout the case, there cannot be an allocation of fault. I don't think you have to ask for an additor at that stage. You get rid of the 22%, and things go back the way they're supposed to be.
So your answer is you didn't, but you didn't have to. That's your answer.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Well, it makes sense, too. I mean, the solution here, the logical solution, the remedy, logical remedy, is simply to say there should have been no allocation of comparative fault in a case like this. In fact, when he was deposed originally, Dr. Schubert said he indicated, no, she didn't do anything wrong. And Dr. Hall several times said, no, I'm not blaming her for doing anything at all, which is sort of persuasive, not just because he's the defendant, but he was also testifying as his own kind of expert. And he's saying, no, she didn't do anything wrong. And yet, the jury, the trial judge says, well, we're going to let the comparative fault. And there's no expert to support that, no disclosed expert testimony. If I may reserve my remaining time for my, whatever you want to call this.
Sure.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to make two quick points about the appeal and then move into a response to the cross appeal. First, I think Judge Bailey, you mentioned that there was no way, or defense counsel never thought that this deposition testimony would come in. Of course, they wouldn't think that. The judge told plaintiff's counsel multiple times pre-trial, do not show the jury deposition testimony. Don't put it up on the trial board.
I mean, that was specifically for opening statements.
It was, but Your Honor, you don't go into closing argument with a plan to violate the playing field that the judges set before day one of trial. Of course the defense didn't think that they were going to see 21 different slides of deposition testimony. They weren't prepared for that. None of it was in evidence. And they did object.
Well, wait. I understand. And use your time. I go back to my initial question is, and we've made clear slide 17, but what substantively the jury heard other than admission that he was careless, that prejudiced, and
sure.
I get what you're saying about prejudice, but what did the jury hear that they weren't supposed to hear?
Sure. And Your Honor, if the trial testimony was better, plaintiff would have used it. That's the whole point of this misconduct.
Yeah.
Is they were supplementing the record after the fact, no notice, without getting that into evidence, you don't just get it into evidence. You have to offer it. The judge has to make evidentiary rulings. And Rule 32A4 makes very clear you can't offer parts of a deposition because that's misleading, unfair. There's got to be a process. That process was not followed. This was trial by ambush. And I do want to just say very clearly there was an objection during closing. That's obviously a delicate thing for trial counsel to do. To stand up and interrupt counsel during closing argument is a very significant step, and they did that here. They said very clearly, this is not in evidence, this is misleading, and the judge said, no, I'm overruling your objection. That's sufficient to preserve. The next quick point I just want to make about this sending a message argument, my colleague said he wasn't sure to whom the message was directed. This was said at the post-trial hearing, and this is plaintiff's counsel. The purpose was I was literally looking at Dr. Hall, and I said, if he's not listening now, will it happen again? I was sending the message to Dr. Hall. That is not appropriate for a compensatory case involving negligence. Standard of care and compensatory damages are what is at issue. Sending a message to anyone, particularly the defendant, is not the purpose of the proceeding. So that's just right there an admission that this was an improperly directed argument. As to the cross-appeal, just very, very quickly, there was no motion for additive. There was no motion at all, Your Honor. And this point about disclosure, it's waived for two reasons. One, they don't say anything in their brief about the standard for receiving appellate remedy on appeal for a failure to disclose. It's called the Allstate factors. It's clear under Arizona law. They didn't make a single argument under it. They didn't give us an opportunity to respond to that. They cited one rule in their opening brief about failure to disclose and no other argument. That's not sufficient. We weren't given an opportunity to respond. Second, all of this evidence that they are claiming came in, they didn't object. There was testimony from our causation expert about comparative fault. They did not object. Plaintiff's own medical records disclosed the comparative fault and the basis for that defense. And, of course, that was disclosed before trial. And sorry, I'm over, Your Honor.
No, okay. We were at time.
Okay, yep, we're at time.
Thank you.
Just letting you, yep. All right.
He waited until right to the very end, but there is something there that I can respond to. There was no evidence of comparative fault other than the strange statement by Dr. Sherbert out of the blue that if you'd done the solutions differently, then there would be, that was the cause of the whole thing. That was never disclosed before. There was no immediate objection to that. It would have been great to have had one, but you don't have to have an immediate objection because they had filed a motion in limine that had been ruled on about comparative fault, so you don't have to bring it up again when comparative fault starts walking in the door. You've already made your objection. And they discussed it at several pretrial conferences about the fact that there was no disclosure of anything that could be regarded as comparative fault.
Could the jury have considered the elective nature of taking more of an amputation than had been originally suggested to her?
Boy,
I don't think so,
Your Honor.
In evidence that the suggestion was the toe and that the, for reasons that were explained, that the choice was to have more of an amputation to try to put off some of the later consequences of speculative antibiotics, more surgeries, whatever the case was. Could they have said, if you're getting damages because you are missing part of your leg, that part of that's on you because you made a choice?
I don't think, well, the comparative fault shouldn't have been in there at all, but as far as, I don't think you can tag the victim trying to save her life with not making choice A as opposed to choice B, especially when you don't know that she had chosen something a little bit different, that it might not have been even more catastrophic later on for her. Maybe the amputation would have been higher. Or maybe she would have died. There's just no factual matrix for the jury to make that sort of decision. They don't have the medical expertise for it. Was she making the right choice here? Well, you'd have to get a doctor to say, this choice was stupid, and here's why, A, B, C. And that never happened. And Dr. Hall himself said, I'm not blaming her at all. Thank you once again. Sorry to be on your docket for so long today.
Fine. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments, and we'll issue a decision in this matter in due course, and we are adjourned.